My name is Mireya Loza. It is the 25th of September, 2008. I am in Wynn, Arkansas, and I am interviewing John Collier for the Bracero History Project. John, can you tell me when you were born?
1943.
Where were you born?
Actually, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, but I was from Parkin, Arkansas, and raised on a farm there.
What was Parkin like when you were growing up there?
It was approximately 1,600 people. Small town, typical, I guess you'd say, country town, where everyone went once a week, usually Saturdays. The streets were full. Businesses stayed open until 10, 11 o'clock at night. You could get a haircut at 11 o'clock at night there then. So they did close Thursday afternoons, though. The whole town closed up. That was their day off, besides Sunday. During that time, when I was growing up, we still had blue laws in Arkansas, so there was no businesses open on Sunday. And I guess you'd say it's a typical small town. My school class was approximately 60 people to start with, and it gradually got smaller. I had 31 in my graduating class, so there were actually 9 boys and 22 girls, I think, if I remember right. So.
What did your parents do for a living?
They farmed. My father worked for different farmers until 1932. I had a chance to buy the land that I grew up on, north of Parkin, and he moved here in 1932. He and my mother married in 1934, and we farmed. Like I say, I grew up on the farm there the rest of that time.
Where were your parents from? Were they originally from Arkansas?
Actually, they were born, both of them were born in Mississippi, but they met while they lived in Arkansas. The families knew each other, but they didn't. They were actually raised 14 miles apart, but didn't know each other. And of course, this was back in the early 1900s, and transportation wasn't what it is now. So,
how many brothers and sisters did you have growing up?
One sister, older sister.
Do you remember how old you were when you started working?
First time, I know my mother laughed about it, the first time I was driving a tractor, I was 8 years old. So I did work in the field some. We chopped cotton, we picked cotton. Although I didn't pick much cotton because I ended up pulling the trailers to the gin. We had a gin. I pulled the trailers to the gin and worked like that. My sister picked quite a bit of cotton, and she was older. And in fact, that is one story, in that my dad told her when she was young that for every 100 pounds of cotton she picked, he'd buy her a savings bond. She went to SMU to college on those savings bonds. So she got her education on cotton, picking cotton. So.
And what did you do after after you finished up school in Parkin?
I attended college, Arkansas State, for 3 semesters. My father had a stroke at that time. I came back to the farm and farmed that year. He got better. Then I went back to school in Texas and was down there about 3 years. He had another stroke. And I came back home and took over the farming operation at that time. Worked for him or as the family for a couple of years, and then I bought the equipment and started farming on my own. Same land that I was renting from my parents, actually.
During that time, you lived in the same home with your parents, or?
Through high school, when I moved back, I lived in a house. We had two different farms that were 26 miles apart. Had 880 acres on one farm, and then we had another one that my father bought in 1951 that was just a little over 1,000 acres. At that time, I moved to into a tenant house we had on that farm.
Do you recall when the first time you had contact with braceros was?
I really don't. It was the early 50s. I remember them coming to work, and I was very young at that time. We had them up through most of my teenage years, or probably until 1959 or 60. I'm not sure exactly when. We had one year that we had BWIs, British West Indies workers, instead of now one season. We got the braceros in the spring to chop cotton, and then they would leave and go on north doing berry picking, I think in Michigan. I'm not sure exactly where they went because of different places. And then they would come back in the fall and pick cotton and go back to Mexico. Well, after they got through picking cotton, they would go back to the valley sometimes and work in the Texas Valley. Picking vegetables and then go back to Mexico, what I was told at the time.
And at that time, where did they live on the farm?
We had, actually we had a tenant house, and beside that tenant house, or close to it, was an army barracks that was a World War II. We had a satellite German prisoner of war camp there. And the barracks was there, and they lived in that. All of it was surplus army cots and mattresses and blankets that were issued that actually I think were probably left over from when we had a German PW camp there. And during the war, you had the German prisoners that did basically the same work. While everybody was off in the war, well, they shipped prisoners over. They had a main camp here in Wynn. And then they had satellite camps in different places, and we had one of the smaller satellites. But it was, as I remember it, it was a three-room, maybe a four-room barracks that bolted together. It came in, and it was a prefab, and I can remember the steel rods and the steel bolts that bolted up the rooms.
No,
it was a... Basically, that one was a shotgun house or a barracks. Just each one room went into the other, no hallways. And they would use one room as a kitchen and then the rest of the rooms to live in. No indoor plumbing. We had a tenant house that they lived in also that was four, maybe five rooms that was adjacent to it. But they had pump water, hand pump. Water and outdoor toilets. I do remember that we were government inspected at the time, or approved under the programs, and the toilets had to be certain sizes. I think they were all two-holers, basically, and then we had to move them every so often. I had to provide lime to throw into the hole to disinfect, and then we would have to cover up, move, and dig another when from where it was. And they sat down from the barracks and from the houses on a fence line. It looked turn row, I guess you'd say, dirt road. But it was primitive. Actually, all of ours, we had 18 houses on the farm at that time, and our house, and we also had a store, a country store, and I had a house beside it, were the only two that had indoor plumbing.
What government inspected the house? U.S. government or Mexican government?
U.S. government, as far as I know, it was a U.S. program. I really don't remember. It was, as I remember, it was the U.S. government, so, and it could have been local people at the time. I don't remember.
How did you guys actually get these guys? Who brought them?
They came into a main camp at Parkin that was controlled by a man by the name of E.D. McKnight. Ed McKnight was where they came to his farm. And then we would pick them up from there. They were hauled in by a gentleman by the name of Joe Garcia at Parkin. And Joe still lives there right now. You might be familiar with him, with the name. Well, Joe came here under that program. Not under that program, but he is the one that ended up in Parkin because of bringing the Mexican labor up here.
How did you know Joe? Did you know him well?
Yes, and actually we're good friends right now. I still see him every now and then. And he... I knew him then, and most of his children were younger than me, and I didn't know them until later on. I'm just acquaintances, but I do, like I say, everyone knows Joe. Joe was one of the good men, sat on the city council at Parkin later on, well-respected, and just, we got along well. So, and he's got a little business over there right now. On the corner at the four-way stop in the center of Parkin. So
Joe brought in all of the braceros for everyone here?
As I remember, he brought the first ones in, and I'm thinking that he was the one that was sent down to Texas or to the border and hauled them back, usually in big trucks. We didn't have buses then, so they would load them onto the back of a truck. Later on, they could have come by bus. I really don't know, because we always picked up our group from the farm, which was just south of Parkin. And that's where each time we picked them up and we would take them back to there. That's where they left from, or came in and left from.
Can you describe a little bit of the work day for me for them? What time would they wake up? What kind of work would they do on an average day?
We always got our groups in the spring, around the 1st of May for cotton chopping. They worked in the cotton fields. We did have livestock and hay, and we used a few. And I remember two particular summers that we kept a group, I think, of six all summer that worked in the hay fields, handling bales of hay. But normally, the years we would get a group in, they would chop cotton until approximately July, and then they went on to, I think Michigan, went on to the berry harvest anyway, north. And then we would get a group in the fall for cotton picking, usually about this time of the year, and they would stay through the fall and the main picking season. We would get anywhere, I think the highest we ever had was 42. We normally kept, I think, around 25 to 30 that would come in.
What time would they wake up, let's say, in the summer when they were here, or in the fall?
In the fall, picking was not quite as early. They still started early in the morning. If you had a heavy dew, you didn't want the cotton wet, so you kind of waited a little while. It was a little easier. Cotton chopping in the spring was basically daylight to dark. Although they did have, here again, it was a government requirement, and it was probably 12 hours. I don't know as far as the maximum, because we didn't. We worked them at that time. I really don't remember what the pay was for cotton chopping. I know that our labor that we had living on the farm, manual labor at that time was $3 a day. Tractor drivers got $4 a day.
You did employ other people alongside the braceros?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We didn't work them together very often. Just because no one worked together. We'd have different groups in different fields. A lot of times with the families, you'd have a family chopping cotton. It might be a grandmother, daughter, two or three sons and daughters, and you kind of put them in groups, and maybe even one side of a field and some on the other side of the field. And then sometimes you'd have them all together. But we did, yes, we did utilize everyone that wanted to work. They weren't naturally forced to because they were being paid, but it, the ones that wanted to work, we'd provide a job. We needed them, or my parents, my father did. So.
Where did you guys find these other families that would work?
That, we always had full houses on the farm. They would move off, come back. I remember we had one set of families that were actually four different houses, but they were all kin. And one of them came from Mississippi. He knew Daddy as a younger man, older gentleman. And then all of his families came up for him.
Families usually,
some stayed, we had some long term, but we had several that would, every 2 or 3 years, they would move. We also had a store on the farm because there was no transportation. No one had vehicles, usually except the landowner. And so they did business at the company store, basically, on the farm. And a lot of times larger families would get into debt, so they would move in the middle of the night. You would end up marking the debt off, and a couple of years later they'd show back up wanting to go back to work, and they'd move back in. But they would just move around to different farms. That was quite frequent. And then you had others that that made a decent living. So what we did, we provided a house. I mean, if you hired a person, you provided a house and a garden spot. And, of course, the house didn't have running water. It had a pump outside. Each place had a pump that went with the house because water was fairly close to the top of the ground. But it was a hand what they call pitcher pump. And then had the outhouses that we built. They could cut firewood on the farm. We didn't provide it, but we did basically was give them a place to live and a garden spot. We had some that stayed with us for years and years, and others that just would come and go, wouldn't stay the season even.
The families.
Mm-hmm.
Were the families, did you oftentimes include black families or white families?
Both. Now, we were probably half and half. I'd have to really stop and think real hard about it, but it was who came by looking for work, and Daddy would usually talk to them, and if he thought they were willing to work, if they had any skills that he needed, which the main thing would be either tractor drivers, and had to have some mechanical ability. And just about every household, he had to have a tractor driver. I mean, that was one of the requirements. The rest of the families, as far as the manual labor, would just hire many families and whether they wanted to work. I don't really remember him firing very many or telling them to leave. Most of the time, he just used them as long as he could, as long as he could tolerate them, because some of them, I mean, we got to, just like nowadays, you had alcoholics, you had some that were hard workers, you had some that just wouldn't manage any money at all, were going to get into debt to you real fast. My dad didn't smoke. He didn't believe in smoking. So the first thing he would do at the store would be to cut their tobacco off. And if they got behind, where they got the owing money, he would cut that off. But I do know and do remember that he never cut off pet milk if it were youngsters in the house or the basic flour and beans, that type thing. But he would start trimming back in and tell them they couldn't charge it at the store. So, which I don't know if that's a control or not, but that was his way of saying you're not going to get into debt with us anymore.
The Braceros, did they buy all of their things in the store too?
The Braceros bought most. Now they, as I remember it, they were strictly flour and dried beans. They didn't. They might buy a cold drink every now and then. We took them to town on a Saturday evening. Usually, if we could get through early, try to do it in the afternoon, and we'd load them on the back of a bob truck. I drove it several times myself, and we would take them to town and park in a certain spot, and tell them that, you know, at 8 o'clock that night or 10 o'clock, whatever time. Usually it'd be 8 o'clock. You'd go early to where you can start back, because this was a 14-mile trip on a gravel road at the time. And we would tell them to meet back at that certain time. Usually it would be two or three that would not be there, and you would have to go hunt for them. And they were usually down. You would find them in what they call down in the bottoms, which was the black area of parking, and it'd be, they had some honky tonks down there.
It's a honky tonk.
Beer joints. So, and so you would drive up to one, and a couple in the group would get out and go in, see if they could find them. Most of the time, we could get everyone back home. There was a time or two that we did not find them, and whether they were in a passed out drunk somewhere, or they also had the houses there, basically a whorehouse. And so, and we would leave them, and they would come walking in on Sunday afternoon, sometimes Monday. But that was not free, you know, very frequent. It was most of the time you got the group back. They would buy there. They would buy if they needed a shirt, clothing, anything extra like that, or if they wanted to buy some groceries that we didn't have at the store. What we did at the store, though, they could buy on credit. Now, one thing about it I remember is that every payday, when we paid off, they would usually send about 80% of their money back to Mexico immediately with money orders. First thing they did, and they would keep enough to live on for the next week, 2 weeks, maybe enough to get them a beer if they went to town, you know. But they didn't keep much money at all.
Where did they send the money orders from?
I really don't remember. They got them in parking when we would go to town, because we paid in cash. Now one thing you have to realize, we did not speak Spanish, or I didn't. My dad spoke very little. Broken. He had, and that's only because he lived in Arizona about 3 years on the Mexican border, actually down in Ajo, Arizona. And he had learned just very limited. Well, you would get a group in, and none of them would speak English. When you got them off, anybody speak English? No, nobody. Well, then you would have somebody, as Daddy would start talking to him, you'd have one that would speak a little bit of broken English, and that was the interpreter for the group. Well, you could find out right quick if you said something derogatory, you'd find out they knew exactly what you were saying, because it would be three or four that spoke almost as good English as you did. I remember one gentleman that I visited with that came in speaking English. He was a school teacher. He was educated. And the thing that stuck in my mind, he said that they could come up from Mexico, work the valley vegetable crop early in the spring, come chop cotton with us, go to Michigan, pick berries up there, come back, pick cotton in the fall, go back to Mexico. He said he could build himself a brick home and not work for 4 years, and he could make that much money at that time just doing stoop labor. And but back to the original story, we got them in as and how you could tell them apart. As we sat down, we had the names, had a list of their names, but we assigned them a number. And what we did, we took a mason fruit jar lid, not with the thread, but just the flat part, and painted a number on it. And then we assigned that number to a name. And so we worked by number, because we didn't, some of the names were the same, you know, or close to the same, and everything. So you had that number, and that they kept that disc with them. And that's the way you did business with who you were dealing with. Picking cotton, chopping cotton was by the hour or by the day. You got paid so much a day. Picking cotton was by the pound. So depending, so you had to, every time they weighed, they get a sack full and you weigh it. Well, they got paid so much a pound. And so you had to keep separate records. And then the payrolls, as I got older, I was helping do the payroll, and you counted the money out, and we had an envelope that we would put their name on it and the number on it, and the amount of money, that was the amount of, whether it was hours or because if it rained or something like that, they didn't get paid for working that day, or if they didn't work. But so it would be different hours, different pay. Or if it were in the fall with poundage, it would be, of course, different prices. And you had that envelope, and you sealed it up. I mean, you put the money in it, and then you called them up one at a time and gave them that, and they would sign that they received it. And you gave them the envelope. And then they would take it from there. And I really think some of them probably pooled their money and did money orders to send back. I really don't know how they did, but I do know that they sent most of their money back to Mexico right straight, and they had enough to live on for the next, you know, week. They ate they would cook on the weekend. They would cook flapjacks on the stovetop, you know, just the tortillas, I guess, what they were. But I can remember walking in and seeing a stack that would be 2 feet tall. I mean, they would just cook them, you know, and get them ready, and that's what they ate all week. It'd be a pot of beans. They when they got ready to go in the morning, they would soak, you know, leave the beans on and soak them, then they'd cook them. But and it might be the pot left from yesterday. But they ate very limited diet, I guess you'd say. Don't remember whether they drank coffee or anything like that or not.
When they went into town, at that time, was parking segregated?
Yes, it was. Schools were segregated, too. But it was, and that was back to, parking was split by a railroad track. And actually behind, the businesses behind that railroad track, where they call, what they call Dye's Bottoms, or it was the Bottoms. It was the black area, and then the white area was the opposite side of downtown. The downtown part sat right in between the two. Schools were segregated then, but there was not a lot of, there wasn't a lot of animosity, anything like that. Everybody seemed to have gotten, you know, get along real well. We had two Chinese groceries there. Actually, one of the girls was in my class up until the 11th grade, and then she graduated early. And the next time I saw her, she was back with a husband because it was an arranged marriage. So, not that that has anything to do with this story, but it was.
Do you know how we got there?
Really don't, because they were there in early when I was in early school. And it was quite frequent. Most of the small towns had Chinese groceries that they came in, they'd open up, ran it. And they might not speak much English either, but they understood business. And I think it was really a network of them. I still believe that. because Susie and her husband now are in the grocery business in Memphis, Tennessee, or were a few years ago. And but I really don't remember how they got there. As far as the segregation, there was, yes, it was black-white. This was the 50s. And but I don't think you had the animosity that you do now. I know we certainly didn't on the farm, because I grew up, and I made the statement several times that I had more black playmates than I did whites when I was a kid. And, you know, we were, it was just a natural, you didn't think about it.
And I'm just trying to understand, in this segregated setting, where did the braceros fit? Did they go to white establishments? Were they welcome in black establishments?
You had some black establishment as far as their main grocery buying or anything like that. It was in white businesses. You had most of the black establishments. You did have barbershops were separate, as a prime example. You had white barbershops. Might have a black working in there, but they didn't, as far as haircuts, it was a different style of cutting hair. And I think from what I had was told at the time, that was as much difference as anything. Was the white barbers didn't know how to cut it. But most of the businesses in Parkin were white owned. You did have some black cafes that were on one side, and actually the whites didn't go that much there, in the same way, vice versa. It was segregated. I mean, the blacks didn't go into the white cafes. And, I don't remember that anywhere in the Mid-South. I mean, this was when it was still water fountains with a black-white on it, or over a door, black entrance, white entrance type thing. And some of the cafes had a black entrance that would be around the side, around back. And the black could go get something to eat and pay for it, but he couldn't walk in and sit down with the whites. I don't remember. I just remember that being there. I don't remember that much about it.
But the Mexicans could go to the black honky-tonks?
Yes. The Mexicans went more to the black side than the white, as far as entertainment and the black honky-tonk. Actually, there were no white beer joints in Parkin. The blacks were the only ones that had the beer joints. And the whites could go to the liquor store, but there wasn't any place they could go in Parkin. Now, you could go to Mark Tree, and they did. Mark Tree had white beer joints along the railroad track. And we were halfway between Parkin and Mark Tree, where I grew up. So it's I ran around more in Mark Tree as I got older than I did Parkin. But we never did take the braceros that way. They always came to Parkin.
How come?
That's where we did business. It's basically Daddy. We were cross county, and Mark Tree was a different county, and we did all of our business in Parkin, did our banking business there, or here in Wynn. And so it was just natural that was the way we went. Doctors that we knew, if we had to take anybody to the doctor, and anyone on the farm, I can remember families that they would come up to the house at night, baby sick or something like that, and Daddy would tell them to get the truck. We had a pickup that was there to tell them to take it and take whoever it was to the doctor at Parkin. So that's just the way it went.
Do you think, I'm also trying to understand, when these braceros went into like places like the honky-tonk, how do you think they were treated by African-Americans?
I really don't know. As far as I know, I don't ever remember any fights. I'm sure there were some, but I don't remember them, us having any problems with it. And normally, it seemed like that they went more to the black than the white. That the white was more of a, the farm owner, I guess you would say, and the elite, the the whites were up here, the blacks were more on their level. I think it would be the easiest way to say it at the time. Some didn't, you know, you usually had some that anytime you took them to town, the whole group did not go. You'd have some that would stay there that week. Now, I don't know whether they felt like they were protecting the place or they just didn't want to spend their money. Because some were hard workers and sent all they could home. I mean, they were working for their families back home.
And the few that went to places like, you know, honky-tonks and these prostitute joints, were they also interacting with African-American women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where, usually where we couldn't find them. That's where they would be. Mm-hmm. But they would interact with them, yeah.
And they couldn't interact with white women, though?
I could have. I don't. Parking at that time didn't have the white side as far as the beer joints and everything. They might have here in Wynn, might have in Mark Tree. I don't know. But parking didn't have the places for them to go. If they were going to go for that, that was where they would have to. So.
And you were talking a little bit before about the year that you guys employed people from the West Indies.
British West Indies, BWIs is what it was called. And I don't remember whether it was spring or fall. I think it was spring. I think it was cotton chopping in the spring. All I remember about them is we brought them in the truck, and I can still visualize unloading the truck with drums, guitars, musical instruments, along with they had a lot more luggage. Now the braceros would come in and they might have a brown paper bag and one change of clothes, if that. But these guys rolled in with suitcases full of stuff and musical instruments, and they were up less than a quarter mile from our house. So at night you could hear the music, you could hear them playing and everything. The biggest shock for me was to see a truckload of blacks get off speaking the Queen's English. Now, they spoke very proper, what I would consider British English, more so. And for me, as a teenager, early teens, that was, I wasn't used to that. I was more used to the black dialect of the South, you know, so. I do remember that they were not nearly as good workers. They were, I guess you would say, lazier. They didn't have the productivity that the braceros did. And so we didn't, I don't know why we never had another group. It might have been that they weren't available. It might have been that Daddy's requested, no, not again. You know, that's, I don't remember.
How did the Mexicans learn how to pick cotton so efficiently?
Usually you showed them everything that we did. If you didn't speak Spanish, it was by do this, you know, you would show them. But they would catch on real quick. They were good at anything they did. They were good at it once you showed them what to do. So there would always be some that would be a lot better than others that could pick an extra 100 pounds a day. Normally, the normal production then would be anywhere from 350 to 400 pounds was kind of average. You'd have some pick 500 pounds. If you were in real good cotton, they might even get 6 or 7. But most of the time, it would be between 400 and 500 pounds a day, which was almost a third of a bale. At that time, a 500 pounds of cotton was considered a bale of cotton in ginned. Clean cotton. Rough cotton, it took hand-picked about 1,200 pounds because you had trash and seed and everything to come out of that. And so they were picking quite a bit.
What's the difference between picking clean cotton and rough cotton?
Well, it's not rough. It's just clean cotton, real good cotton, where you've got a good high stalk, a lot of bowls to one stalk versus where the stalks are lower, closer to the ground, the bowls are scattered out, hadn't opened well. Usually, because then you pick cotton a couple of times, you would go through the first picking, and that was the prime picking, when about half of it opened. You would go back later on and do what they call snap, where they would pick bowls and all, but they wouldn't open as well. There'd be some misformed there, but you got everything you could. So you didn't get nearly as much then. Snap cotton didn't pay as much either when later on in the season, because it was a lot more trash. You had the not just the lint cotton, but the whole bowl part. So it, in fact, I think the last picking was probably about $2 a hundred is all we paid on it, because it took so much more to make a bale.
Do they pick, I guess, the same quantities as the local families?
Usually more. Now, we always had, I know we had one gentleman that was older, black man, and he could outpick anybody on the farm. And he was one that would consistently hit 650 pounds or so. I mean, just day in, day out. And the same way was when you put him in the field, if he were chopping cotton, he didn't stand and talk to anyone else. And I know some of the others would get mad at him because he took his row and he chopped right on down the row, and he would walk off and leave them, and they'd get mad because he was showing everybody else, you know, and they would be a little lazier or whatever. Same with picking cotton. They would start on the end of a row, and you'd just see him. Normally they would take, like he would take two rows. He would get in between one, you pick this row and pick this row. And you didn't have to go as far because you were pulling, most people had a 9-foot sack. Some had 11 or 12 foot, which was a super long one. But even with a 9-foot sack, it would hold 80, 90 pounds or better, and you would be dragging it. So it'd get heavy on the shoulders. But they had learned to pick here and pick there and put in. When they weighed it, and this was whether it was the local families or whether it was the Braceros, the weighers, we would inspect the cotton basically as it went on the trailer, or someone would. And that was to make sure it didn't have dirt in it, rocks. That add to the weight. I mean, they find a brick bat or half a brick, and you stick it in there, you know. Because what happens, particularly with the rocks or anything, when it gets to the gin, it can start a fire just from hitting the machinery, hitting it and sparking. Well, it wouldn't show up until the bales sitting on the dock might be a day later or 2 days later and start smoking. And all that was where it caught a spark in the gin, but the bale went around it and it sat there and smoldered for a time. So you would check when they went to dump their sacks in the trailer. Well, you would get a pair and you would check the cotton just to make sure it was clean and they weren't putting extra stuff in the stalks or whatever, so adding to the weight. So.
I was
going to
ask another question about these men's interactions with their families in Mexico. You said they sent back their money. Did they ever write letters?
Letters and letters came in. Now they would write back and forth.
Did they come into your house or the post office?
The postman delivered to our store. It was not a post office, but it came. They would write the address on and use it to our farm, and he would deliver it to the store, and then we would take them right there and give them their letters. And the same way they would mail it. They would come in and bring their letters there, and. So it acted kind of like a post office, although it was just a general store. But the postman came by 6 days a week. And mail was delivered out there every day. And some would even get packages from home. Not very often, but they would get. But letters were frequent.
Did you ever have any of these men fall sick?
I don't remember any accidents. I remember that we had one that we ended up taking to the doctor, and he had ulcers, and we sent him back. Now, whether he went back to Mexico or just back to parking in some other place then, but he was not able to work because of stomach ulcers. Only one that I remember as far as sick. We had one that we sent back for refusing to work at that time, too. This was in the hay field. He decided it was too hot and the bales were too heavy, and so Daddy loaded him up in the truck and took him back. But other than that, I don't ever remember out of all the years of us sending anyone back or being sick. I'm sure there were. I only remember the one ulcer.
And where would your daddy take them?
They went back to parking, and from there, I don't know whether Joe Garcia took them or shipped them or through Ed McKnight through the where the program started or not. So I really don't remember there.
So this Ed McKnight, he was a big proponent for the program in parking?
He was just a farmer, farmed and ginned, and it seemed that that was the place that they came in. I know Joe came in and worked for him for several years back then. So Donald McKnight, the son, lives in Jonesboro now, I think on Culber House. And he would be one. He's a little older than I am, so he would remember quite a bit of this also.
When was the last year you remember them being on the farm, roughly?
Probably 58, 59, maybe. I don't think 1960, but it could have been. But I'm thinking 58 or 59.
And why did you guys stop employing them?
I think that the federal government eliminated the program and stopped them. And as I remember it, all at once we couldn't get them. And I don't know whether it was a federal mandate that they dropped the program, or at the time they probably started getting so much flack that locals were losing their jobs or something like that. I really don't know.
In parking, did you ever hear stuff like that locals felt that they were losing their jobs?
No, I didn't, but that's the only thing I heard was some of the families we'd have on the farm, they would gripe a little bit about, them taking their work, or they were working so hard, and something like that. But that was more of jealousy, that I don't want to work as hard as they do. Because they were hard workers, very hard workers. And I guess you'd say very productive at the time, because it was all stoop labor. Of course, most of farming then was stoop labor. It didn't matter whether you were black, white, or Mexican, Bracero program, or what. It was just manual labor, anyway you looked at it.
So. Did you guys ever employ Mexicans that didn't come through the program? Mexicans that came either undocumented or Joe, Texas Mexicans?
We had a family, as I was told about, this was actually pre-war or early 40s. That lived on the farm, and I don't know what exactly happened to them. I know that my mother had told me that one time they found out that they were growing marijuana on the river down there, which we were on the St. Francis River. So I don't know whether Daddy made a move or whether they were arrested, because I'm not sure if they even had marijuana laws back then. So. But we did have a family that I was told, I never knew them. That was either when I was a real little baby or before I was born. So,
that was from Texas or just Mexico?
I don't know. I was just told it was a Mexican family. The mother had talked about it and told me where they lived. The house was still there. I mean, I knew the house and knew where they were there, but don't know them.
What happened to the farm then after the Mexicans left?
A lot of mechanization, chemicals. Early 60s, you started getting more chemicals for grass control, weed control, and which to eliminate a lot of the chopping. Pickers got better, mechanical pickers. We had actually, my dad had the first international picker west of the Mississippi River. And it's the same model as the ones in the Smithsonian now. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but we had one just like that. That one picked right along with the Mexicans or whatever, because at the time we were raising 600 to 700 acres of cotton on our farm. And so we did use mechanical pickers. But that's, I think, as much as anything, when you start in the early 60s, we started getting better chemicals, or started getting chemicals, actually, and using them, and then better machinery. So.
None of these Mexicans ever wanted to stay there on the farm, or?
I'm sure they did. Don't remember. I know that we had one or two letters after, and I say one or two, it could have been more, all I'm aware of, asking Daddy to come back to sponsor them for the next season. You know, for the, even under the program, it was, they would ask to come back to that particular farm. I don't really ever remember getting any on a return trip. And I think that's just because of the way they migrated, that somebody said, I need a group of 20 or 40 or whatever, and they just took, you know, start here, 1, 2, 3, and you go here, and then the next go somewhere else. I don't, like I say, we could have gotten somebody back, but I don't remember it. So, but I do know we had some that asked to come back, but I don't remember having it. Did the same way with the German prisoners. We had some that asked to be sponsored after the war that wanted to come back. So
then in the 1960s and 1970s, there was mechanization on the farm and there was chemicals. Do you continue to work the farm as well as your present job?
No, I farmed. Actually, I farmed up until 1995. And then I retired and didn't do anything for 3 years, and got so bored that I had to do something. And that just happened that I'd had a burglary at the farm. And I was down here talking to the sheriff at the time one day about it. And we were just talking. I said, well, I'm going to have to do something. I'm tired of sitting around. And he offered me a job. Actually, as an investigator. And I said, I don't know anything about law enforcement and investigating. He said, all you got to do is listen to people. And I said, well, I'll let you know. And I thought about it, went back and told him I'd try it. This was first part of May. And I said, well, I'll give you till the end of the year. I'll work that long. If I like it, you know, stay. Well, he got beat in the election that year. So we had a new sheriff. He hired me. I stayed on. Moved into the management end of it, and that's all I do now is shuffle papers, I guess you'd say.
So until 1995 you had your farm?
Yes. Well, I still have the farm. It's rented out. I mean, I still own it right now. Actually, my sister and I own the family farm. My dad passed away in 1974. My mother died in 1998. And my sister and I inherited that part of it. I also expanded and bought land myself that I own separately. But I rented, everything's rented out. Now we have another man farming it. So, actually, a young man that was raised on the farm. My dad rented half of the farm out, or the home place where the Braceros were housed, in 1960, and farmed the other farm until the second stroke in 67. And that's when I came back in 68 and started farming that one, ran it. So the man that's farming it now is the son of the one that Daddy rented the original farm to in 1960. So it's been in the same renter since then. Last, what, 48 years. So.
Simon, do you have any questions?
No.
No? Thank you very much. This has been really interesting.
Well,
actually, let me ask one last question. So, in general, did you think that the program was positive or negative?
I think it, from our standpoint, it was very positive, and it gave us seasonal labor that you needed then when you actually couldn't get enough hands, you know, for a 6-week period in the spring and then the fall, something like that. And you didn't have to house year round or provide jobs or hire people and lay them off or have to hunt labor one or two at a time, that you could get a group. And we usually based the numbers. I know the number would vary, but it was based on what Daddy felt like he needed at that time. If we had all the houses full and good, say teenagers, you know, older children in there, it could work. We might not get quite as many. But the least I remember us getting was 28 and the most 42, and it could have been in the range and what was available then. It might have been that they brought in, say, 100 and divided them up among a half a dozen farmers. And so people might not have gotten as many as they needed, but they got an average of what was in the group. So, but from our standpoint, it was positive.
Thank you very much.